Welcome to Masters of Dispute Resolution on Podclips. This podcast is designed to offer valuable perspectives and insights to individuals engaged in the mediation process. Listeners will benefit from the experience of the profession's most accomplished mediators who share compelling stories of conflict and the lessons they have learned from handling challenging and intriguing disputes. Throughout the episodes, you will hear firsthand accounts of how conflict has impacted the lives of those involved and discover how mediation enables individuals to move forward free from the burden of ongoing disputes. The discussions on this podcast provide practical guidance on addressing and overcoming difficult issues, helping listeners achieve more satisfying outcome in mediation. Whether you're a mediator, an attorney, or someone who has participated or is considering participating in mediation, you'll find actionable advice and encouragement. Your host, Len Levy, is a mediator and arbitrator with ADR Services, Inc., a leading provider of alternative dispute resolution. Len brings extensive experience, having litigated complex cases for over 30 years before transitioning to mediation in 1998, and has been recognized as a super lawyer in alternative dispute resolution beginning in 2014. Len Levy's expertise and dedication set the stage for insightful conversations and meaningful learning for all listeners. And now, your host, Len Levy.
Thank you, Daryl. Welcome and thank you for joining us for Season 6 of Masters of Dispute Resolution, a podcast designed to add tools to your mediation toolbox. We're brought to you by ADR Services, Inc. and the American Institute of Mediation. Now, in each podcast episode, you've been hearing stories about conflict, the impact it had on the lives of those involved, how resolution was achieved, and the lessons learned from both the conflict and its resolution. Many of the details may be altered to maintain the essential confidentiality of mediation while still capturing the core of the conflict and its resolution. Today, we will be discussing a sexual discrimination case. And our guest today is Mikan Shelton, who has unique skills. And I will tell you, unique skills in terms of, and background, in terms of being able to not only conduct a mediation very, very efficiently, but also to convey how those skills should be applied in the workplace, and has given within her background as, for example, Senior Vice President of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for both 20th Century Fox and Warner Media. Mikan led impactful diversity initiatives and facilitated dialogue between management and internal and external groups, and trained executives. And she still continues to train attorneys and mediators who listen to what Mikan has to say, because it's always, always insightful. She also has a background as a litigator and has developed an insight into those types of things that might happen in a trial if that were to go forward. None of us as mediators have a pipeline to gods and can predict the future, but it's certainly well worthwhile for those who mediate with Mikan to pay attention to her insights, because they're very valuable. And so with that, Mikan, thank you very much for agreeing to be part of this podcast. I'm just sitting at the edge of my chair waiting to hear what this case was all about.
Great. Well, thank you, Len, for having me. I'm excited to be on your podcast and to share a mediation that I had and some of the insights that I learned from it. And one of the things I've learned in employment mediation is that sometimes the hardest part of the case is not the legal dispute itself. It's the party's trust in the process. And this was a mediation where I realized during pre-mediation calls that the success or failure of the day of our mediation was probably going to depend less on the legal arguments and less on the numbers, and more on whether the plaintiff felt she had agency in the process. Okay, the case involved a woman who had relocated across the country to work for a large consumer-facing company with a very public image around diversity and inclusion. Before joining the company, she built a very successful following online as an influencer and an entrepreneur. She was really smart, ambitious, creative, and she saw this opportunity to transition into a major corporate role as something that would really allow her to build a long-term career. So she uprooted her life. She moved her family from the East Coast to the West Coast, and she had a lot of hopes and dreams tied up to this big move. And instead of the company living up in her mind to its public image, embracing diversity and inclusion, when she got there, she felt deeply alienated almost immediately. In the lawsuit, she described comments that were made about her hair and her appearance and interactions that she experienced as racialized and really dismissive of her talents, really flattening her out and really just preying or deploying stereotypes. You know, she described a fixation on her nails and her hairstyle, that she was given nicknames. You know, people would talk and call her girl, and would use words like ghetto to describe her ideas. And there was a, you know, kind of office culture of sending around memes that very often featured Black people. She felt that it was very much directed at her. And she felt that these things explained why she was not given high profile assignments when she got there. She felt like she was heavily recruited. She was convinced to come, and she was sold just these big dreams. And when she got there, she was not given the assignments that she thought could demonstrate her skills and her talents. Instead, she was getting, you know, the smaller assignments, the lower profile assignments, and she was watching her male counterparts get these high profile assignments.
So there was kind of a feeling of bait and switch to start out with before we get to any deeper that she's upset about that.
Exactly. Certainly. Exactly. So there was a bait and switch with respect to the company culture and what it stood for. And then there was a bait and switch in terms of what she was recruited to come in to do. So to her, those were already right off the bat very, very concerning. And then so to get in there and then feel that, you know, there was just a disproportionate amount of attention paid to her body, her, you know, kind of her outward appearance, her nails, her hairstyle, all those things is not what she was hired in to do. She thought, okay, yes, that was my persona before. That was my influencer. That was the content that I made a name for myself, you know, and then caught the company's attention. But now I'm hired for a totally different job. Now this is no longer about my external appearance. This is no longer about my public profile. I came in to bring in these talents and these skills I have in marketing into this job. And yet she was not given a chance to demonstrate those skills, according to her, right? She felt that that when she got there and the people that she was working directly with were demeaning to her, and that she was constantly called out and, you know, humiliated in front of her coworkers and other people. So that was her perspective. Now, the defense saw the case completely differently. Right, they viewed many of the interactions that plaintiff complained of as kind of mutual banter that she engaged in, that she was among, you know, friends and among coworkers that she socialized with. Like there, she admitted, like, yes, she would go out with her coworkers, and that she would engage and she would use the terms, you know, girl and ghetto, and that she was, you know, circulating memes herself. She said none of the ones that she sent had any racial connotation. And so, you know, she thought that hers were very different than what she was receiving. And she also acknowledged that hair and nails were a topic of constant conversation amongst employees because they were talking about nail art and they were talking about, kind of an external manifestation of identity through hair and through art. So she acknowledged that, but the difference for her was when she says it as part of the job because they're in this particular industry, that's very different than when people are disproportionately fixated on her own nails and her own appearance and her own body, which was a large part of it.
Was the discussion, at least from the defense standpoint, basically centered on the type of industry, or it came about as a result of the type of industry that they were in? And you haven't shared that yet. And is it relevant to the backstory here?
Yes, it was a beauty adjacent industry. But really, the defense perspective was that none of this was unwelcome conduct. None of it was conduct that she did not also engage in. And none of it was based on race or gender, right? Hair and nail as art is not, according to the company, race or gender specific. And so they had this very, very different take. But what was important is to them, what was important to defend and what they kept focusing on is they were sensitive to it. They said, look, we understand the difference in perspective. And so when these complaints were made, when plaintiff made the complaint internally, according to defendant, they took it very seriously and they hired an outside investigator who came in and did a prompt and thorough investigation. And now according to defendant, they took the appropriate remedial action. They counseled people, they coached people, they sent everyone through training. So they said, look, we responded exactly the way you would want an employer to respond.
In other words, where's the beef?
Where's the beef? Where's the beef? Right? That's what the defendant was saying. And then the plaintiff was saying, I'm being microaggressed every day. And I'm dying by a million cuts over here. And for you to be so dismissive of all these things tells me you're completely missing the point. And so that's where the tension was. And after they did the investigation and the disciplinary action and all the coaching, she continued to work at the company. But other incidents would arise where she would then complain about retaliation. And so this went on until ultimately she filed this complaint and we got here into mediation.
Let me interject a question, because you've described how the company had investigated and instituted some changes. Were those changes acknowledged as being effective or alleged to be ineffective by the plaintiff?
Plaintiff said they were ineffective. She said that the retaliation was by way of assignment, by way of setting her to a higher standard or evaluating her against a higher standard, nitpicking her performance, having a much lower tolerance for any error that she made. She described incidents where she made trivial errors that other people would make too, but then she would be berated in front of other people. Mm-hmm. And the defendant said it was a very, very tough work environment. They acknowledge exacting standards, but they thought that this applied across the board, not just to her. There was a completely different interpretation of what largely was undisputed facts or incidents, but completely different interpretation. The defendants were not seeing it the way the plaintiff was, as she is the only Black woman in a work environment of hundreds of people, and she was the only one. And so for there to be so little sensitivity about how these memes, conversations, comments, all these things affected her was very deeply disturbing.
At this point, we are just about where the mediation starts. But as I understand it, the mediation that you conducted, Mikan, was not the first mediation. And When we get back from a break, we will be discussing things like what took place to resolve this, what was effective, what was not, and what had to be overcome. I'm Len Levy. This is Masters of Dispute Resolution. We'll be back right after a break.
Masters of Dispute Resolution would like to thank ADR Services Incorporated, your partner in resolution, and its founder, Lucy Barron, for supporting this podcast. ADR Services is one of the leading providers of alternative dispute resolution in California. Leveraging technology to drive resolution, ADR Services is committed to dynamism in the face of growing client need and an ever-evolving legal climate. Now operating offices in all major legal markets of California, ADR Services provides unparalleled in-person and remote resolution services through its exclusive panel, comprised of more than 130 of the most distinguished and talented neutrals across the state, capable of handling challenging and complex mediations, arbitration, and other procedures in every field of law. When you seek the services of a neutral and you want results and satisfied clients, contact ADR Services, www.adrservices.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and my guest today is Mecon Shelton, who has just told us the story, background of the story, of a sexual discrimination claim. And from what we have been discussing, it seems that everyone agrees on the facts, but the spin is something else, right?
That's right. The interpretation was completely different.
Right. So when you were presented with the prospect of mediating this, what did you initially know and how did you get the mediation started?
Well, as I typically do, I scheduled pre-mediation calls with each counsel. And with plaintiff's counsel, they told me that there had already been a prior mediation that failed with a different mediator. And there was a different attorney representing the plaintiff at the time. And the fact that this was a second mediation is not entirely uncommon. I mean, Len, I know, you know, we're familiar with that, right? Sometimes
yes.
It takes a second mediation or sometimes it takes multiple sessions and that's fine. And you work with that. But on this call, it seemed curious to me why there was new counsel involved. And I wanted to learn more about what happened in that last mediation and really what had transpired since so I could prepare for this mediation. And counsel explained that the plaintiff felt pressured into accepting a mediator's proposal she was not comfortable with. And she described comments that were made during the mediation. Now, I don't know whether the comments were made or not, or how they were intended, but according to counsel, plaintiff felt very insulted. She felt very dismissed. And she felt like there were comments made to her in the mediation that were culturally loaded. There were comments like, this is a lot of money for you. And comments suggesting that just because she worked in this, you know, kind of beauty industry, that she should have expected comments about her appearance. And she should have expected that people would be looking at her clothes and her body. And so again, I'm not judging another mediator, and I don't know if those comments were made, how they were made, how they were intended. But what mattered to me was how this particular person, this plaintiff, experienced that mediation.
Right.
She came away from it feeling very small, feeling unheard, stereotyped, and pressured. And that history told me that I needed to approach our mediation that day, our mediation session, very carefully. And I realized that if she felt pushed, she would probably disengage. So I noted that, and I was very careful about that. And so the pre-mediation calls helped me design the process. Both counsel said they had already exchanged information. They were already in litigation, so there's already a lot of discovery. They had already exchanged a lot of information. They'd already exchanged documents, including the investigation report. And then, obviously, they had the other mediation where there was a lot of conversation. It was a full-day mediation last time, so they felt like that all that had already been done, and they had had extensive conversations getting to this mediation. So they both told me this is a mediation that should probably get right into numbers. They said, look, plaintiff had already told her story. She already told the, and this is now defense telling me, She's already talked to the investigator many times. And the mediator in the last mediation had said that she had already told her story in mediation. So defense counsel were really eager to get to the numbers to see if there was a negotiation that could be reached. And plaintiff's counsel didn't entirely disagree and thought the same, thought that maybe having her relive the issues and have to redescribe them would get her just more entrenched. So both counsel were telling me, let's try to get to the numbers quickly.
Those are kinds of suggestions that we often hear in pre-mediation calls. I always make pre-mediation calls as well. But you concentrate on one thing that the counsel, both counsel told you is she's told her story. But
Yes.
I'm also hearing she told her story, but she didn't appear to believe that she had been really heard.
That's exactly it. That's Len, exactly it. That was my sense too. So even though I'm very respectful of counsel's input, it's their cases, they know the cases, their case better than I would based on, the briefing that they gave me. They know their people and they know right the what is needed. But I also had the sense from everything they said that even if she had told her story, she had not felt heard, and that we were already in a very tenuous space of building trust around the process because I could not tell that she trusted the process, even though she agreed to come back into mediation. It was at her attorney's behest and suggestion that she come. So I believed, even taking in counsel's input, that it would be very important for me to determine that myself by talking to her in the beginning, by getting a sense what she needed to talk about that day. So I spent a lot of time early in the day just simply listening to the plaintiff. I asked really open-ended questions about how she was feeling, what she hoped to accomplish in mediation that day. And there were long stretches of silence. And, the me, like you described me earlier as efficient, I am constantly thinking about how I could resolve the most efficiently and make sure that we use our time wisely so that we get to a durable settlement at the end of the day. But here, I really wanted to sit with her in those silences as she was gathering her thoughts. I really let those silences bond us, right? And so instead of me typically like saying, okay, you know what, I'm going to give you time and you can go off camera and gather yourself, and then in that time I'm moving to the other room so that there's no downtime. Instead of doing that here, I very purposely just sat with her in her silence, and so that I could really demonstrate to her and really that I was really trying to connect with her and really trying to hear her. And I would repeat back to her what she would say, what she was saying, so that she knew she was being understood accurately before we got serious about settlement discussions.
I'm picking up that this is via Zoom, right?
Yes.
Okay. And was she present with her attorney in that space, or was it just you and her?
She was in her home. I could see that she was, and I was glad to see that she was in her own comfortable space. Her attorney was in the attorney's office, and then I was in my home office. And so, the three of us are constantly on screen together, but I was also very much working with her counsel. Like very often I'm just texting with counsel or I'm pulling counsel aside, I'm having chats on this on the side with counsel just to check in, just to get input, because I very much wanted to make sure I supported that relationship between counsel and client, especially because this counsel is relatively new to the case after that last mediation. And so I wanted to make sure I did not undermine that relationship in any way. So yes, all three of us were together, even though I was speaking directly to the plaintiff herself, the client, I was doing so very much in collaboration with her attorney.
And her attorney was allowing that process to go forward,
Yes. Yeah.
trusting your instincts as to what was needed in that situation.
Yes, very much.
And was her attorney a male or a female? And would it have made any difference if the opposite was true, so to speak?
The attorney was a woman. I've worked with many men who are compassionate and caring and patient and do very well in, sexual harassment, racial discrimination, all sorts of different cases. So I'm not sure that the gender exactly mattered, but her style, her compassion, her empathy, this lawyer's care for her client was very evident. And I think that made a
Got it.
difference. Okay.
Okay.
Meanwhile, defendant in the other room is getting antsy because they want to see if there's a deal to be had. But the numbers reflected a very significant gap. And just going back for a second to the prior mediation, they had ended very far apart, and both sides came into this mediation with very different understandings of where the negotiations should even begin. The plaintiff viewed the prior mediator's proposal as a kind of floor, as a, the benchmark as the floor. And the defense viewed the prior mediation very differently because both sides had rejected the proposal. And the defense believed that the plaintiff's prior position remained unrealistically high. So even the history of the negotiation was disputed.
Oh
And
boy.
we exchanged a couple of rounds of numbers, but fairly quickly it became clear that continuing to trade positions was not really going to move the mediation forward. At that point, the parties weren't really even negotiating numbers. They were sending messages to each other, right? Defendant was saying, your case has no value. There's like no chance you're going to prevail, and we are going to defense this. We have every defense available to us. And plaintiff was saying through her numbers that the defendant wronged her, and she was deeply injured and hurt by this. Midway through the day, the defense made a conditional move, and this was for them intended to test whether there was a realistic range where continued negotiations would even make sense. And it wasn't a typical bracket where, kind of everyone's reading the midpoint. The defendant said, no, we mean this to be a conditional offer, meaning we will only move off our number and go to X if plaintiff comes to Y. And she can get to Y through a bracket or through a hard number. We just need to cut through this and see if we're even going to be in the same range. And I had some concerns about this approach, and I talked to defendant about it, and I understood what they were doing, and I understood, why they needed to do it. Even though I offered different alternatives, and we, I kind of asked them to be patient and let this breathe a little bit, but I could understand from them, second day, now into the afternoon, are we going to be able to get to a deal or not? And they were understandably eager. When I brought this to the plaintiff, she was really upset. She viewed this as another version of being pushed around. As tactfully as I communicated it, she heard it as an ultimatum that if she did not move the way defendant wanted her to move, they were going to end the mediation. And this was a critical moment because what defense thought was a practical negotiation move, she experienced as another loss of agency. And so I immediately reassured her that she does not have to do anything she does not want to do. And at that point, though, I knew the back and forth and the positional bargaining was done. Like that was over. That part of negotiations was over, and it wasn't going to work any further. So instead of continuing to negotiate in that way, I shifted us into more exploratory conversations. And I reminded her, and her attorney reminded her, this is her mediation. She's the decision maker. We're here to explore what options are available for her and not force anything on her. And so that helped the conversation. We started focusing on, really what the path, different paths forward were for her, what it would mean for her to stay at the company, what it would mean for her to leave, what was she hoping the company would become, and how much of her own identity and future had become tied up in trying to make this experience feel worthwhile after uprooting her life for the role. Because, there were the legal claims, but underneath
Right.
the legal claims, there was that human conflict. And she didn't want to feel like she was leaving, like for her to leave the company meant the company was getting away with something. But at
So,
this,
yeah,
yeah, at the same time, she wasn't happy anymore. Yeah, go ahead.
the issues are what at least way back in the day were referred to as below the line issues.
Yes,
They
absolutely.
were issues that existed. They weren't going to be issues that were going to be brought up in court. But if you're talking about resolution of a claim, there are things that might drive a party to move off of a number or change position, et cetera, based on fulfilling some need that is not apparent. And
Exactly.
so is that the direction that you guided the parties in?
Exactly. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. That's what I was exploring in the plaintiff's room, really thinking about what she wanted for her future and, what the trade-offs would be. And then in the defense side, there was a whole nother conversation happening. They remained very consistent in their view that they had handled the situation appropriately. As I said, they were standing behind their investigation that had been done by an outside investigator. They believed they had addressed the complaints promptly, appropriately, and thoroughly. But our conversation really expanded beyond liability. We talked about the reality that something was happening that was being understood very differently. And we talked about how workplace cultures could feel very different to insiders versus someone entering from the outside. And we discussed how even if the company did not believe race or gender motivated the conduct, a jury could still view the broader dynamics through that lens, especially when you had an outsider employee experiencing repeated comments and slights inside an established internal culture, right? The culture of the company was one of long-tenured employees. And so when this new person comes in, right, perhaps they were treating her a different way because she was new, but you could easily see that she was new and she's Black and she's a woman. And so at a certain point, the defense began looking at the situation less as did we technically violate the law, and more as what does it mean to resolve this situation responsibly and then use the opportunity to address issues related to corporate culture? Like, is that what we want in the company, to have a culture that is not conducive to bringing in new talent? And so once both sides shifted away from pure positional bargaining, the negotiations became much more productive.
And basically recognizing that the driving force really were fulfilling interests. I mean, that's the
Exactly.
fulfilling the interests changed the dynamic from how much is going to get paid.
Exactly.
And so knowing when to shift this is something that doesn't happen by accident. You are aware of what's going on, even if you're not articulating it directly to the participants in the mediation. And so knowing what tools to use
Yeah.
essentially is it, right?
Exactly. I mean, knowing how companies work, knowing what's important to companies, knowing the questions to ask to understand their priorities, understanding their tolerance for change, what they can take from this lawsuit to see, so that they did not feel that they were quote unquote overpaying for these claims, but really there was some thing that they could learn and improve their company and improve their culture. Those were important conversations to be had, but we needed to really surface those issues and surface those priorities. And I needed to listen to see if there was a receptive audience, because not all people or defendants and companies or defense counsel are open to it, and that's fine, right? You really need to figure out what are the interests of the parties, and that is making sure to ask the right questions, to elicit those interests.
Well, we're going to take another break and be right back after a word from the American Institute of Mediation.
Hi there. We hope you're enjoying another fascinating episode of Masters of Dispute Resolution. Has the show ever made you think about becoming a mediator and doing the work you're hearing these experts doing? Are you thinking about it right now? Imagine a career where you're working to help people in conflict find win-win solutions. The sense of purpose you'll feel can easily be heard in the voices of the guests on this show and its host, expert mediator Len Levy. Or maybe you're a mediator already looking to build your skill set in order to pull off some of the brilliant and out-of-the-box solutions that these guests are talking about. That's where we come in. We're the American Institute of Mediation, and we train mediators of all levels. We're the place you come to learn the basics of mediation or to raise your game in the field. We specialize in mediating commercial and litigated cases, but we teach the skills in such a way that will work in any setting. Our slogan is world-class training for the complete mediator because we feature the world's best mediation trainers and we prepare you for all aspects of being a professional mediator. Find us online at AmericanInstituteOfMediation.com and browse all of our courses that are available for streaming on demand. You can watch our courses at your convenience, at your desk, on a plane, or in bed in your jammies. We'll see you in the mediation world soon.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and I have been chatting with Mekon Shelton, who has just demonstrated how insightful a mediator she is. And so we're at the point where I can't wait to hear what there was a resolution, right? Did she stay? Did she leave? Was money paid?
Yes.
Tell us.
There was a resolution. So, once both sides shifted away from pure positional bargaining, the negotiations became much more productive. And the plaintiff began confronting the reality that she had been holding on to this job partly out of fear of starting over, fear of losing the dream she thought she had joined. And then the defense confronted the business reality that continuing the employment relationship came with its own ongoing risks and costs, even if they believed they had acted completely appropriately. And eventually the parties reached a resolution that worked for both sides. The plaintiff did leave their employment and there was a monetary settlement. And both sides were very happy and very satisfied. And it wasn't because they changed their minds necessarily about the merits of the case, but I think it was because they finally had a process that allowed them enough space to think clearly about what resolution could actually mean for them, what resolution could mean to improve the business and to focus energies where they wanted to focus their energies within the business. And for the plaintiff, for her to let go of the weight and the heartache of what she was experiencing and give her a chance to start over and to give her a chance to really build the career that she wanted to inside a company that was going to really honor her talents. And so I was really excited for both of them because the resolution, we could tell by the end of the day, was a relief and a really satisfactory outcome for both sides.
Right. And, you know, how many times have we heard counsel say, well, a good settlement is both people are unhappy? I'd never ascribe to that. And I don't think you do either.
No, not at all. That is that, you know, it happens when they're both sides are a little bit begrudging about it, but I go in with the goal of making sure both sides understand their alternatives, understand the options. And so at the end of the day, they're picking the option that's best for them. And if you're picking something that you think is best for yourself and your own interests, mm-hmm. there's got to be some satisfaction in that.
Right.
And so, yeah, so and that happened here. So I was very glad for it.
So the prior mediator had used a mediator's proposal.
That's right.
And I believe you said that the parties treated that as a floor or a ceiling, and that led to a disconnect in terms of where the negotiations were starting. correct?
Correct.
Okay, so the time to make a mediator's proposal is a skill. I mean, it really is, deciding when that has to happen or when that can happen, when the parties are within a range that you are, as a mediator, confident that at least you have a shot at getting this settled. Because I think in this case, you said they had both rejected the mediator's proposal.
Correct. And look, I'm not here to criticize any other mediator. I don't know, you know, what happened exactly in that first mediation, but it did not work. And it did set a floor for the plaintiff that we had to contend with. For me, I do a mediation proposal as a matter of last resort. I don't go in assuming I'm going to make one. I don't go in, you know, talking to the parties about setting up, you know, the day to make a mediation proposal. But I do it and I use it as a tool when both sides want me to. And when I have high level of confidence, really, really high level of confidence that both parties will accept it and that their attorneys are going to recommend to their clients that they accept it. And that at that point, then I'll, you know, make the mediator's proposal. And, you know, for the most part, I've had great success with them because I'm very cautious. And it might be because of this experience in this case that has caused me to be cautious in the cases that I've mediated since. But, you know, I don't take it lightly, and I don't use it as a, you know, a matter of course.
Or a substitute for actually drilling down and finding out what parties' interests are. Because because one of the elements of this resolution was something that required you to understand where the interests of each side lay and how those interests could be reconciled, with both parties pushing, and I'm not sure both parties in this case, but when parties start pushing for, well, we've got to get to the numbers right away. Has your experience been, you lose a lot by doing that?
Well, here, the plaintiff's counsel was pushing to go to the numbers a primary concern was that replaying the facts and going through the allegations again would have caused the plaintiff to really focus on the wrongs and not be forward looking. Right? Mm-hmm. And so I the very valid concern. Mm-hmm. I thought there was the conversation that I wanted to have that we ultimately had with the plaintiff was trying to excavate those interests. And an interest that came up in our conversation was that she wanted to be a part of the company living up to its public values. She believed in diversity and inclusion. She thought the company believed in diversity and inclusion. And it was just the people around her, this particular department, this particular unit, that was not living up to the company's values. And so she wanted to be a part of that change. That felt very important to her. But ultimately, if she did not feel that she could do that, at what cost was she going to stay at the company? And could she have that opportunity to make an impact on another company? Could she have the opportunity to really, you know, put her efforts where they could have maximal impact? And that was a decision that we talked about in the room. And so that was very valuable because it was something that really opened up the conversation to the numbers and allowed there to be some room, because otherwise, you know, we were stuck. They were stuck with the numbers because they were just sending these messages to each other.
Right. So did you at any time have meetings with counsel, just counsel and both sides together?
Not both counsel together, but I, throughout the day, would do a, you know, temperature check with mostly plaintiff's counsel. With defense counsel, I did too, because the company rep was on East Coast time and was really eager to move through the day very quickly. And we just needed more time. And so I would check in with defense counsel on, okay, what can we do? Can we just call them back when we need to later? What are the hard deadlines at the night? Because this went late into the night. This is something that went very, very late. And so I was mindful of that time and talking to defense counsel about how we could deal with the time zones and the eagerness to get this done while leaving the plaintiff's room with time to have the discussions that I felt we needed to have.
What was the resolution once it was articulated? Was it was there a discussion about, do we do a deal point memo? Do we do a final agreement? How did
Yes.
that come about, and what was ultimately decided?
Well, it was so late in the night that everyone was exhausted. They did not have the energy to go through the actual agreement. And so I did a confirming email that laid out the, main deal points. And yes, there was some nervousness about that, just given how delicate the parties were and how delicate, and it did feel a little bit fragile in the moment. But once we went through the deal points, and once we both had counsel say, okay, yes, we're going to agree to that, I sent an email asking both counsel to reply that they are confirming that that was the deal, and then the attorneys worked out the long form agreement after
Got it.
that.
Got it. Yeah, because that comes up very, very frequently. What are we going to be able to do today? As a matter of fact, it came up in a mediation yesterday. Okay, so.
I highly recommend the confirming email and having both counsel reply at least to that, so that there's some confirming that comes from not just the mediator but from the attorneys themselves. But yeah, even better if you can get the agreement signed. That is the goal. But yeah, it wasn't going to happen that for this one.
I've been in mediations that lasted in excess of 20 hours,
Oh my gosh, that's
you talk about people who are ill-equipped after 20 hours in mediation to actually parse through language.
Exactly,
So very
exactly.
difficult. I actually had to break up a fist fight in that between councils. It's a whole nother story,
Oh my gosh.
but in any event, look, we're at the end of our time now. But before we go, are there any other lessons that council should take away from this mediation? Is there something they should have done and didn't, or that they did do that was particularly contributing to the resolution?
I think these attorneys were so great about how prepared they were, how much time they spent preparing and talking to me in the pre-mediation context. These were very conscientious, very prepared attorneys, and they had, worked with our clients to prepare their clients. So I think all those things really, really helped. I also think it was very important that they had their own ideas and opinions about how the day would go, but then ultimately deferred to me when I suggested maybe a different course of action. They didn't take my suggestion in the defense room when I suggested they don't do the conditional offer, but for the most part, throughout the day, they took my lead on timing. They took my lead on how to negotiate. They took my lead on, not insisting on positional bargaining. And so I feel that the trust between the counsel and the mediator is so important to give the parties just that much latitude to use as many of the tools that we mediators are trained in, right? And so we're trained to be flexible, agile, think on our feet, and make the most of what we have showing up in the room at that day. And that takes flexibility, that takes trust from the attorneys. And I really appreciated that in this case, and I think it was crucial to coming to a resolution.
This has been a marvelous, marvelous conversation. I hope that we can do this again sometime. This would be great. I'd look forward to it. And before we wrap up, how can listeners contact you to learn more about your practice or book a mediation or anything along those lines?
Yeah, well, thank you, Len, for your good questions and for inviting me onto the podcast. You could reach me at mshelton@adrservices.com. And I'm on the ADR Services website. I hope people do reach out. I love talking about mediation. I love mediating. So please, anyone can reach out on the website or on my website, sheltonadr.com.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. And thank you, Daryl Wade, engineer and producer. I'm your host, Len Levy. This is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, powered by Infogen Labs. And before we go, just keep in mind that I hope you continue to enjoy the stories we bring you, and stay well, keep listening, and remember, peace of mind is enhanced when conflicts are resolved.
If you wish to contact Len Levy, you can reach him through his email at lslevy@adrservices.com, through Len's website, lenlevymediate.com, telephone him at 818-903-5562, or contact his case manager at ADR Services, 213-683-1600.